Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
There's no safe area. Where shall we go? Stop the war. It is enough. We are drained. Everyone is drained. Children are gone and adults are gone. Everyone is gone and the world is watching.
The death toll in Gaza continues to climb as Israel attacks shelters for the displaced and aid distribution sites. We'll go to Rafah for the latest. Then we look at the decimation of Gaza's economy. Israel's agreed to send millions in withheld tax revenues earmarked for Gaza to Norway to be held in escrow instead of to the Palestinian Authority. We'll go to Ramallah to speak with the Palestinian economist Raja Khalidi. And the New York Police Department has launched an investigation after Columbia University students were attacked with a chemical spray during a pro-Palestine demonstration last week, with eight of them seeking medical attention.
It felt like for a while, like the university, like, didn't believe us. Like, I told them about it, and it's like my concerns weren't really being taken seriously. And it wasn't until students started posting photos of themselves being hospitalized and tagging the university, being like, at Columbia, like, we are like, they started taking it seriously.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Al Jazeera is reporting at least 20 Palestinians died earlier today in Gaza City when an Israeli tank fired shells at people lining up for humanitarian supplies. Another 150 were injured. This comes a day after at least 12 Palestinians were killed when Israeli tanks shelled a UN shelter in Khan Yunis, where hundreds of Palestinians had sought refuge. At least 75 people were injured in the attack, which resulted in a major fire. Israel denies carrying out the attack. The UN said the shelter was struck by shells from a tank, and only Israel has tanks in Gaza. Israel's assault on Khan Yunis has left the city facing a growing humanitarian crisis. Authorities at the besieged Nasser Hospital say supplies of food, anesthetics and painkillers have run out. Israel also continues to attack the southern city of Rafah, where hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians have fled seeking safety.
We are displaced, and they bombed us. My son is a martyr. We are told to go to Rafah because it is safe. I have 50 families staying over. They bombed and destroyed us. Where do we go? Where is the safe place so we can go to? My nationality is Egyptian, but I can't enter or leave. I don't even have a tent to stay at. They bombed us, and my son is a young martyr. Where do we go? The old and helpless people, what can they do? Where do we go?
On Wednesday, British Foreign Secretary David Cameron met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Cameron told Sky News he pushed Netanyahu to accept a pause in the fighting.
It's time for an immediate pause in the fighting, because we've got to not only get the aid in, but crucially, we've got to get those hostages out. And what I think we can do now is plan for how you turn that pause into a permanent, sustainable ceasefire without a return to fighting.
This all comes as the death toll in Gaza has topped 25,700, including over 11,000 children. The International Court of Justice has announced it'll deliver an interim ruling on Friday in South Africa's genocide case against Israel. South Africa's asked the court to impose a number of emergency measures, including ordering a halt to Israel's assault on Gaza. This comes as a new poll in the United States shows more than a third of Americans now believe Israel's committing genocide against the Palestinians. In Tel Aviv, thousands of Israelis shut down a major highway Wednesday, demanding their government reach an immediate deal to return the over 130 hostages still held in Gaza. The protest was led by a number of women's groups and the families of Israeli hostages. Meanwhile, hundreds of Israeli protesters have gathered at the Kerem Shalom crossing for a second day in an attempt to block a convoy of humanitarian aid trucks from entering Gaza. The protesters are demanding no aid for Gaza until all of the hostages are released. The BBC has revealed new details about how the United Arab Emirates hired U.S. mercenaries to carry out over 100 assassinations in Yemen beginning in 2015. Targets included politicians, imams, and members of civil society. Two of the mercenaries who work for Spear Operations Group spoke to the BBC and admitted taking part in the assassination program.
If we felt like, yeah, okay, he's a legitimate target, we're good to go.
Who gave you the targets?
We received the target intelligence from the UAE government.
How did you receive them?
In intelligence packets.
Cards?
Cards.
How many cards did you receive?
10 to start.
And one of them was Ansaf Mayo?
Yes.
U.S. Africa Command said Tuesday U.S. strikes in Somalia killed three members of al-Shabaab on Sunday. Somalia is the fourth country the U.S. has bombed since the start of the year, in addition to Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. In labor news, the United Auto Workers Union has endorsed Joe Biden for president. Biden addressed auto workers during a labor conference in Washington Wednesday. Biden's speech was interrupted when UAW members stood up and called for him to support a ceasefire in Gaza.
I carry an automobile, a tanker, a staircase. No matter what that was, it should be built.
Biden's UAW endorsement comes even though UAW has publicly called for a ceasefire, while Biden refuses to, leading some members to oppose the endorsement. UAW President Sean Fain also spoke Wednesday and thanked the president for joining striking auto workers on the picket line during the union's recent stand-up strike against the Big Three. Fain used part of his speech to blast Biden's likely challenger, Donald Trump.
Donald Trump is a scab. Donald Trump is a billionaire, and that's who he represents.
The Ohio Senate voted to override Governor Mike DeWine's veto of an anti-trans bill banning gender-affirming medical treatment for youth. The House also voted to override the Republican governor's veto earlier this month. The law, which also bars transgender students from school sports, is set to go into effect in 90 days. The transgender advocacy group Trans Ohio said it's been in touch with dozens of families who feel under attack and plan to leave Ohio. In Minnesota, prosecutors charged a state trooper with second-degree murder for the fatal shooting of Ricky Cobb II, a black man, during a traffic stop in Minneapolis last year. 33-year-old Cobb was a father of five. Trooper Ryan Londrigan, who's white, shot Cobb after he attempted to flee in his car while being questioned during a traffic stop. Mary Moriarty, Hennepin County's top prosecutor, vowed to hold police accountable after being elected in 2022 as the city was still reeling from the 2020 police murder of George Floyd. A federal judge has sentenced a January 6th insurrectionist and Proud Boys member to 6 years in prison. During a sentencing hearing, Mark Brew of Washington State told the judge, quote, "You could give me 100 years and I would still do it all over again." During the insurrection, Brew harassed U.S. Capitol officers, prevented them from moving forward using a barricade, and took selfies inside the government building. Prosecutors say that after January 6th, Brew tried to organize another violent insurrection in Portland, Oregon. Over 1,200 people have so far been charged with crimes related to the Capitol insurrection. In Alabama, prison officials are scheduled to execute Kenneth Smith today using nitrogen gas asphyxiation for the first time ever. On Wednesday, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected Smith's plea to halt the execution. His lawyers argued attempting to execute him for a second time after he survived a botched lethal injection in 2022 constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. Another appeal remains pending before a circuit court over using the untested method of execution via nitrogen gas. The case has gained international attention. A high-profile Italian nonprofit linked to the Vatican spoke out against Smith's planned execution this week. This is Mario Marazzitti, Italian journalist, politician, and death penalty abolition advocate.
Kenneth Smith's execution risks to be a milestone execution, if it happens, because it sets a new standard. It lowers humanity at the level of a state that has a frenzy and a killing fury against one individual. So it is the litmus test for the level of civilization today if we are losing the battle of a culture of life, and a culture of death becomes just normal, as it is normal in times of war.
In Texas, state authorities continue to bar federal Border Patrol agents from accessing its border with Mexico, defying a Supreme Court order issued this week. Texas troopers are still erecting razor wire along the border, which has cut off most of Shelby Park near Eagle Pass, a city park on the banks of the Rio Grande. On Wednesday, a Texas official says a 35-year-old man from Nicaragua drowned in the Rio Grande. Two others were rescued. Last week, a mother and her two young children died in the area while attempting to cross the river. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, Donald Trump's reportedly pressuring Republican senators to reject a bipartisan border bill because he's concerned passage of the legislation could help Joe Biden's reelection chances in November. In Argentina, labor unions led tens of thousands of protesters in a general strike against President Javier Milei's so-called shock therapy economic policies. Since taking office last month, Milei has ordered massive spending cuts, shut down half the government's ministries, devalued the peso by more than 50% against the dollar, ordered the deregulation of business and the privatization of state-run industries, and cracked down on the right to protest. This is Guillermo Picagnini of the Workers' Socialist Movement Party.
What are we demanding for the fall of the decree of necessity and urgency that seeks to give public power to President Milei? What do we want for the omnibus bill to fall? It doesn't only take away our social rights, it also transforms the right to protest into a crime.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza, where the death toll continues to climb and Israel's relentless assault continues. At least 20 Palestinians were killed today and 150 injured as they were lining up for humanitarian aid in Gaza City. This, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, with the number of casualties expected to rise. The attack comes one day after a crowded UN shelter housing tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians in Khan Yunis was struck on Wednesday, setting the building on fire. At least 12 people were killed, over 75 wounded, when two tank shells hit the site, according to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA. The Israeli military, the only actor on the ground that has tanks, denied it carried out the strike. Meanwhile, the Israeli army surrounded and isolated the two main hospitals in Khan Yunis, Nasser and Al-Amal, stranding hundreds of patients and thousands of displaced people inside. That, again, according to UNRWA. A third hospital was evacuated overnight. In recent days, thousands more Palestinians have rushed to escape further south, crowding into shelters and tent camps near the border with Egypt. Over 1.7 million people have been displaced in Gaza, and more than 25,000 have been killed in Israel's assault over the past 3 months. We go now to Rafah, where we're joined by Akram Al-Sattari, a journalist who's been covering developments on the ground. He's joining us from just outside the Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah, the southernmost city in Gaza. Akram, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you describe what's happening in Rafah and the reports of what's happening in Khan Yunis?
Well, Well, the situation in Khan Yunis is aggravating in such a very serious way. The bombardment and the targeting around the hospitals that you have just mentioned, Al Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis Al Amal neighborhood, Al Khair Hospital that was stormed by the Israeli occupation forces, and people there who are staff were interrogated, and people who were internally displaced people were arrested. Nasser Hospital has been the subject to some massive attacks, and some of those attacks targeted also UNRWA designated shelters that are located in the immediate vicinity of the Nasser Hospital. The clinic, the UNRWA clinic that is in the heart of Khan Yunis refugee camp, was the area of its vicinity was also targeted. People were asked to leave their homes, and some of the people who were leaving their homes were reporting about a journey of horror, devastation, and imminent death that they have been seeing. They have been reporting about them seeing the people who are dead on the ground without anyone daring to reach them or to collect their bodies or to try to extend a helping hand for the people who are screaming for help because of their lethal and bloody injuries. The KYTC, the KYTC that is run by the UNRWA and that is also recognized by Israel as a designated shelter and protected shelter, was targeted once again. And now people who are staying in there, who are in thousands, are asked by the Israeli occupation to move from that area towards Rafah area in the very south, which means that there is more targeting underway, which means that they would be afraid, and the ones who were killed and injured who were taken to Rafah rather than to Khan Yunis because of the fact that Israeli occupation closed the way between Khan Yunis coastal area and Khan Yunis refugee camp and Khan Yunis downtown. So the situation is aggravating in that way. Hundreds of people are injured. Tens of people are killed. Also, not far away from Khan Yunis, in Gaza City, the people who were waiting in Al-Kuwait roundabout were targeted. They were waiting for the humanitarian assistance because the situation in Gaza City and the north is extremely dire. People are already suffering from famine, very lacking situation when it comes to the food supplies and drinkable water. They're waiting there. 20, as you said, 20 were killed. 150 others were injured. The new about this report is that among those 150, there is a very large number of people who are sustaining very critical life-threatening injuries and who might be reported as killed, which means the number of victims of this bloody attack is expected to rise significantly in the coming hours. So the situation continues to feature large-scale bombardment in Khan Yunis, displacement of people, destroying of whole blocks and houses, people moving and they end up targeted when they are moving, designated shelters that are supposed to be protected. Now the people in them are asked to be IDPs once again, given that the IDPs in that area are coming mainly from the north. People who moved from the north to Gaza City, then moved from the Gaza City to Gaza Central area, then moved from Gaza Central area to Khan Yunis area, and then from Khan Yunis, they moved to the KYTC, and they are now asked for the fifth or sixth time to leave the area that they were seeking safety in and to move in a very unsafe path towards the unknown in southern Gaza, in Rafah, which the targeting is still continuous. Number of people who are killed in Rafah is still increasing, and the Gazans at large are not aware what the future holds of them, with the number of IDPs reaching 1.9 million Gazans in all different areas, including the coastal area in Khan Yunis and the already heavy populated area in Rafah.
IDPs, of course, internally displaced people. Akram, if you can describe the telecommunications blackout and the effect it has on people trying to communicate with each other, find each other, get to hospitals, reporting of injuries, and also, I don't take for granted that we're able even to speak to you today in Rafah, in Gaza. And if you can talk about how you both report and take care of your own family.
Well, if I may speak from a very personal perspective, I personally was under that imminent threat of death in Khan Yunis. I lost communication with my family, with my sister, with my nephews and nieces who lost their father. I lost contact with my son. I was wondering how can I possibly survive under the imminent threat of fire. And when I say an imminent threat of fire and death, I mean that seven people were targeted at the door of our home, the home that was hosting us, and the seven people, no one ambulance could reach them. We were trying to call 111. which is the ambulance services, 101, which is the ambulance services. We could not get through to them. The communication blackout, looks like it was intentional for the sake of cutting all communication and cutting the coverage and trying to keep Gaza isolated from the world and keep Gaza voiceless at the time that the Israeli occupation was developing the ground operation and was targeting the different areas in Khan Yunis and throughout the Gaza Strip. I lost communication and I was and am still facing significant challenges reporting, moving, and you never know when you are just driving in a car or just riding a taxi, or just even riding an animal pulled cart, you know, don't know whether they are going to target someone who's walking down the street, someone who's next to you on that animal pulled cart, or maybe they would target you. So it's very difficult to understand in Gaza what's coming next. It's very difficult to predict who they are going to target. It's very difficult to predict why they are targeting people. But the bottom line and the conclusion that we see with our own eyes, that the targeting is thorough, the destruction is larger than ever, and the suffering of the people because of that ongoing policy is unconceivable. Unconceivable in the sense that I personally had to move and see the people who are dead and to try to move. And while five or six other houses around me were targeted, why I could see the artillery fire taking out whole house when I was moving in Khan Yunis area or was staying in the area that I was waiting for the situation to be a little bit safer to move. But it turned out the situation was getting from bad to worse and the targeting was getting heavier. I was staying in the area that is called 111 area, which is a block that was designated by Israel as a safe area. And the across from our area was 112 block. But the bombardment was in 111, 112, 107, 48, 86. All the blocks were targeted all at once, and that ground operation seemed to be indiscriminately sending death and destruction all over the area. So with that comes, as you have just said, the struggle to survive, to struggle to stay sane under this ever-escalating situation and to look for 1 minute of peace. I was personally thinking just yesterday that we are wanting some 1 second of rest and peace, even if that means we would die, even if that means they would take us, even if that means they take our life for the sake of just keeping us peaceful. So this is how it unfolded in Gaza, and this is how it continues to unfold. People are dying, people are scared, people are displaced, and they think they are even uprooted intentionally, and there is an eradication attempt that is taking place in Gaza. The Israeli occupation has been targeting every single corner in Khan Yunis. Khan Yunis refugee camp that is extremely populated and overcrowded was targeted. When you target one house in one specific area, that means you are likely to affect around 20 to 30 houses because the areas are very narrow and the space that is limited for every house, and we're targeting one place, explosion in one place, means that this explosion, the implication of that explosion would reach, or the secondary wave of the explosion would reach around 20 to 30 houses.
Did you know the reporters that were killed most recently? I mean, the numbers are just astonishing. The Committee to Protect Journalists, Reporters Without Borders are all decrying the number, ranging between 80 and 120. But the latest killing of journalists, for example, Wael al-Dadu's son, Hamza al-Dadu. Did you know Mustafa Thuraya? I know that Wael has just gotten out of Gaza. He's head of the Al Jazeera. And he is now been operated on in Qatar. He's now at Al Jazeera headquarters. His cameraman, Samer Abu Dhaka, who died in the attack. These reporters, were they friends of yours? I think we have just lost Akram. Absolutely amazing that we were able to maintain that length of time in speaking to him in Gaza. He was speaking to us from Rafah. Akram al-Satari is a Gaza-based journalist joining us from southern Gaza. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the Palestinian tax revenue, Israel is refusing to release it, but has made an agreement with Norway to hold it in escrow. What's happening to Palestinians' money? We'll speak with a leading economist in Ramallah. Stay with us. By Ahmed Eid. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's assault on Gaza has exacted a devastating toll, with over 25,000 people killed, 63,000 wounded, 1.7 million at least displaced. Among the consequences of the offensive is the decimation of Gaza's economy. Even before the latest Israeli assault on Gaza began over 3 months ago, Gaza's economy was already crumbling, the result of a 15-year-long siege on the territory enforced by Israel and Egypt. Now, with vast swaths of Gaza destroyed by the Israeli military and severe restrictions on humanitarian aid coming in, more than 500,000 people are facing catastrophic hunger. That's according to the United Nations. Meanwhile, Israel's withholding millions in taxes collected on behalf of Palestinians earmarked for Gaza. On Sunday, Israel approved a plan to send those tax revenues it's frozen since November to Norway to be held in escrow instead of the Palestinian Authority. While the PA was ousted from Gaza in 2007, many of its public sector workers kept their jobs and continue to be paid with transferred tax revenues that are being held by Israel, further exacerbating the crisis in Gaza. For more, we're joined by Raja Khalidi. He's the director general of the Palestine Economic Policy Research Institute, joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Raja, thanks so much for being with us. If you can start off by talking about whose money is this, and talk about the amount that's supposed to go to Gaza and to the West Bank, and how Israel has control over it. Why do they have control over it?
Thanks a lot, Amy, and for this chance to talk with you. Before plunging into the dirty details of the economics of this war, I just want to just say a word of tribute to the journalists like Akram, so many of them who've been reporting, who've been shocking us every day. And what is more shocking, and we're talking about millions of us watching, listening around the world here in the rest of Palestine, what is most shocking is that they're able to still do their job so well and so professionally. So, I mean, we'll come back to Gaza, but really, you know, you don't need an economist to tell you what's happened to the economy of Gaza. We just heard a lot. It tells so much of a story. The entanglement of Palestinian authorities' public finances with Israel goes back to Oslo. Funnily enough, it's come back home to Oslo, in the sense that this was all part of an arrangement made for a five-year period whereby Israel was allowed, because of de facto when Oslo agreements were signed, to control the collection of Palestinian external trade taxes at its borders, because it, of course, controls all the Palestinian trade, both that trade that comes from Israeli economy as well as from around the world. So that set up a mechanism called the clearance mechanism, whereby all of the recorded imports through Israel or from Israel to the PA are calculated and handed over on a monthly basis to the Palestinian Authority. Now, this was a suitable arrangement in the interim period that was supposed to end in 2000. But then it was perpetuated because nothing else took its place since then. But gradually interpreted unilaterally by Israel in its own, according to its own financial security and political interest. So from early on, this mechanism became one of the weapons, if you wish, of economic warfare. And pacification or warfare, so carrot or a stick, that Israel has used in its relationship with Palestinian economy, with Palestine, with the Palestinian people. Now, that has entailed over the years, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, unilateral deductions that Israel makes. So it makes reductions for